You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore, joined once again by Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniele Friberencini.
Buonasera.
With a working computer. And Ian Boswell.
Thanks, Richard.
Iannaccio Boswelli. Surely.
Damn, yeah, no? I didn't... I'm sure...
Just an advance warning, the first time Ian mentions risotto, I'm hanging up. Pasta.
Oh, goodness me. Oh, dear. Sorry again, American audience, all 29% of you who listen to the podcast. Daniel doesn't mean it. He's joking. He has his tongue firmly in his cheek. Oh, Daniel, honestly.
Pasta.
Anyway, our Ratner's moment. Anyway, you look that up if you don't know what the Ratner's moment is. Anyway, onward with stage 13 of the Giro d'Italia. And, I mean, not really looking ahead too far yet to the Tour of Flanders on Sunday, which I'm going to, but we will have a clip from Julian Alaphilippe's press conference, very amusing clip. We're going to hear again, I think, tonight from James Knox, the latest entry in his diary. But what happened to the sprinters stage today?
Wow.
Everywhere I looked, it was a sprinters stage today, and it didn't look like much of a sprinters stage to me. Did they miss the memo?
Well, yeah. It was flat with two climbs near the end, wasn't it? A bit like a mini Milan-San Remo if you move the finish along to Ventimiglia instead. Because the thing that lured me into thinking it would be a sprint finish was that there was quite a bit of time between the summit of the final climb and the line for everyone to get back on. And I just thought, well, everyone will get back on. I didn't really appreciate just how difficult the two climbs were. The first one was longer... And then the second, I think the first one was about 4 kilometres long, the second one was a couple of K long, but they both had very, very steep sections, didn't they? But Richard, got to pick you up because there was a sprint finish. It just didn't feature any of the actual real sprinters.
yeah, you're wedded to the old cycling there, Lionel. This is the new cycling. And we saw it at the Tour where a climb can be at 5 kilometres into the stage and the non-sprinters teams can use it to get rid of the sprinters or the dangerous riders. It was a fascinating stage, actually, in the end. And well, in the end, De Koon and Quickstep did an awful lot to keep that front group away and clear of Peter Sagan, Ben Swift and so on. Will we get straight into the tail of the Tapa, though, before we give too much else away? Not quite.
We ought to tell everyone who won the stage. Diego Ulissi of UAE Team Emirates won the sprint against a group packed with all the GC contenders. It was Ulissi's second stage win of this Giro and the eighth of his career, and he edged out the pink jersey Joao Almeida, who added 6 vital seconds to his overall lead, and he's now 40 seconds ahead of Wilco Kelderman going into tomorrow's time trial. Bora Hansgrohe's Patrick Conrad with third, a bit of a consolation prize for them because there was a group coming up which featured Peter Sagan, Thomas De Gendt, Ben Swift and Davide Ballerini. They came up short in their bid to get across to the lead group on the run-in. Things had really split up on that penultimate climb where the sprinters all went out of the back door. Demar and Viviani were distanced, but Arno Demar's Groupama FDJ teammates did a fantastic job to get him back in to the front group. They went right back up to the GC, the front of the GC group as they hit the bottom of that final climb. And, well, it wasn't quite enough because Demar and co. were again out the back. And perhaps surprisingly, Peter Sagan lost lost touch with the front of the race on that climb. The final two survivors from the day's break, Geoffrey Bouchard and Alessandro Tonelli, they were caught. Then there was an attack by, or certainly an acceleration by, Teo Gegenhardt of Team Ineos, and that started to fracture the group. The King of the Mountains leader, Ruben Guerrero, went over the top first, and then James Knox.
Teo Gegenhardt, nickname. He's got a new nickname, I heard the other day. Ian might already know this. We've been calling him Gap Year for several years, but apparently he's known as Wiki on the Ineos bus now.
Yeah, I can see that nickname.
Because he's of his encyclopedic knowledge about a variety of subjects, Wikipedia.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, you heard that, Ian, before?
There was a Slovenian soigneur on Sky for a while, and we called him Siri, like on an iPhone. But I would definitely see Teo being Wiki.
Wiki, of course, as our friends at the official Giro podcast, the Italian Giro podcast, very, very dryly, drolly pointed out the other day. Very useful because Google is not at the Giro.
Well, it'd be good if he loses time one day, and we can say WikiLeaks.
They're actually,
you see, but he's actually not leaking time at all. He's climbing up, isn't he? He's up to 12th overall now.
Indeed. Well, yeah, he was looking sprightly on the final climb again, wasn't he? And then once they'd gone over the top, James Knox and De Koenig Quickstep, they pressed on. They kept the Sagan and Demar groups from coming back. They really had no chance to come back. And that was it. A stage win for UAE Team Emirates. Ulysses second of the race. And tomorrow is the time trial. And that really will be one for the time trialists.
Oh, some other news before we move on. It was Tale of Tap rather than news roundup, but some big news today, really. The Equipe Polcar, which was previously Bigla Katusha, they were taken over by Polcar, the French fashion house, when Bigla and Katusha pulled out earlier in the year. And it's all an illusion, it appears. No money has been paid, or very little money has been paid by Polcar, and not only is the team sort of struggling on without a sponsor, but the team has gone. The team has closed. The riders are now without a team and can't ride the remaining couple races at Tour of Flanders and Dipana. So a very sad story, and we'll be joined. One of our guest presenters during this block of coverage will be Lizzie Banks, who rides for that team, or did ride for that team. So we'll speak to her a bit more about it, and also maybe find out what her next move is going to be.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWocker. If you run a business, find out more at iWocker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thanks very much to iWocker, our title sponsor. They've been with us since March, and we're grateful to them for their support. And they support you if you run a small business. Go to iwoca.co.uk to see the information that's there about what they can do to help you in terms of loans and so on, including the coronavirus business interruption loan scheme, of course. So iwoca.co.uk for more information on iWocker, and thank you to them. So today's stage, Diego Ulissi, his second stage win. Agrigento was the first, wasn't it? He's normally a rider who sort of specialises on these little uphill finishes. Today it was a pretty select group that came to line, and he was fastest, but run pretty close by Joao Almeida and Patrick Conrad, which was quite a surprise to me anyway. I wasn't aware that Conrad had that sort of finish on him. Almeida's obviously just in great form. But what did you make of the stage? Anything, it was obviously a kind of a battle for the stage, initially to get rid of the likes of Demar and Viviani, and then to get rid of the kind of the sprinters who can hang on the climbs, like Peter Sagan and Ben Swift, who were threats. It was a kind of whittling down process. But did we learn anything today about the race and about who might, you know, contend to win it, and who might go well tomorrow?
I my first observation was just how small the peloton is now after a few teams have left the race. It's incredible to see, you know, there's a breakaway of five or six guys up the road, but to see how small the peloton actually is. And the stage today reminded me of like a traditional Italian under 23 race when there's 120 some odd K of just flat roads and nothing. And then you hit the final and you have these ridiculously steep climbs. And yeah, it was an exciting finish for what was a relatively uneventful first 90% of the race.
Well, Rich, the only thing that's preventing me from saying this already is that I'm slightly intimidated by being in the presence of a former World Tour rider, Ian. But these are my former these are my former training roads. You know, the Colli Euganei when I lived in Padova. This is the gym, private gymnasium when of cyclists in Padova. Everyone heads out from the city into this little sort of very very small cluster of volcanic hills, and I must admit, I'd never done certainly it was the first of the climbs today. I didn't know it, and I'd never done a climb that hard in that particular range of hills. They're usually quite benign, but I guess as far as the course is concerned, what it showed, I suppose, coming after the stage at Sagan won the other day to Tortoreto Lido, is that we always look at the altitude gain in stages, or we do nowadays, and really what matters is the altitude gain in the last 30 or 40 kilometers, not the rest of the stage, in terms of creating a spectacle and you know, even creating a race where the GC riders sort of come to the top and can, you know, cause damage, can create time gaps. I mean, it's not always like that, I know, but it's been a bit of a pattern this year, partly by virtue. We've been blessed by these points jersey competitions, both in the Tour de France and the Giro, that have really had quite an effect on the GC battles, I think, in both races, maybe to a slightly lesser extent, you know, today, with the Ciclamino and Sagan trying to distance Dimar. But I think it's definitely been something that's really spiced up the racing in both of the Grand Tours. And having been a real kind of afterthought and a real sort of a marginal issue in the last 10 or 20 years. On that note, chaps, I mentioned the Ciclamino jersey, and of course the current custodian is Arnaud Démare, and we've been hearing throughout the Giro, haven't we, from his lead-out man, Jacopo Guarnieri, and we'll hear from him again now.
So, here we are. I'm on my way to the hotel. It was a long transfer today after the stage. Definitely wasn't an easy one. Well, we could split the stage into two parts. The first was really, really quiet. Headway and then super nice roads, and the final 30k, 40k, that was really, really hard. We knew it was a bit complicated for us to stay in contact with the main peloton, but and we know also that our main contender was Ethan, because actually, and obviously, he's looking for the Ciclamino jersey. But well, I will say, he was so focused into dropping us that at the end he opens up a nice way, a red carpet for the GC guys, because he went so hard on the first climb, and then on the second, all the big guys, all the big names up there in the GC as well with Dovizi, they were feeling so good, and they see the opportunity to shake things in the head of the peloton, and they did. So yeah, we were not really can I say confident for our results for today's sprint, because we knew it could have been pretty, pretty difficult to have a sprint. We were just looking to maintain a decent gap in between us and Peter, and actually it turns out pretty, pretty good, because we even get one extra point in the intermediate sprint. So far was a nice day. And well, tomorrow it's we're really happy there is a time trial, so it's not like a rest day, but for us it's a little bit easier, because yesterday, well, that was a horrible day. It was super cold and super hard climbs, and Gruppetto was made under 10k to the finish. So yeah, it was pretty, pretty long day. Well, let's hope to have a nice dinner. That's of course we don't, because we have our own chef. And yeah, not much to say. I think the tiredness start to start to be there for everybody because, yeah, on the paper, this stage was looking, yeah, hard, but still something for the sprinters. And at the end, there were just 20 riders up there. So that says a lot how hard was. Anyway, the first 2 weeks, even though like on the TV or on the map, it seems like way easier, but yeah, it isn't. And especially the meteo is starting to be really cold. And I heard, I didn't check because, I don't know, you know, for the lucky, I didn't check yet the forecast for the next week. And I hope just this stay dry because even today was really, really cold. Actually, we were lucky it was not raining. And well, let's see what's coming next. Tomorrow, I will be one of the first to start, gladly. So I have plenty of time to enjoy the GC guys, you know, going a block over the parcours. And for me, it was just a survival camp tomorrow and another time. So, yeah, see you soon. Ciao.
Yeah, well, we all thought that Sagan was going to have another stage victory. I certainly did. Yeah, we saw my former teammate, the young and tiny Matteo Fabbro, rip it up on the penultimate climb. And I was really thinking that Fabbro was going to keep the pace high and Sagan was going to actually be able to go after a stage victory. But it's, yeah, that second climb really, you know, when you look at the profile of today's stage, as Daniel said, that the climb was incredibly steep for how short it was. I think it was only 2.5K. And the fact that Sagan wasn't able to pass it, yeah, and even on the downhill, I thought that it was a 15-second gap for a while. I thought he was going to be able to come back. But in the end, no, the GC riders, and to be honest, Quickstep put on quite a show today. I mean, Knox and who's the other young? Masnada?
Masnada.
Yeah, I mean, for those...
The eel of what is it? Brembila. L'anguilla di Brembila.
And what's Masnada called? Does James Knox have a nickname yet?
Not yet.
Peeps, maybe, for the quality of his diary.
Well, just watching the stage, I actually have a question for you, Daniel. What's the deal with the Italians loving the slow-mo playback of oftentimes something that's completely irrelevant to the race?
Oh, I don't know. I've noticed that as well. And you're looking for what it is that they're actually playing back and you can't find it.
No, I mean, today there was just a video of a guy walking in the feed zone. And I was like, waiting for him to trip or something, but nothing happened.
Ian, I was going to ask, you mentioned Matteo Fabbro. He's been quite a revelation, really, of this Giro. But does it surprise you? It's funny sometimes. I remember a couple of years ago... watching a stage of the Vuelta with Fran Reyes, and Richard Carapaz was on the attack, and Fran knew Carapaz pretty well and had just never seen him at the front of a race like that before, and he was pretty shocked. What's it been like? Did you see these performances coming from Fabbro, or has it surprised you?
To be honest, it has kind of been a surprise. I was with him for 2 years, and obviously he's a phenomenal climber, but you see more and more in the peloton in this day and age that riders tend to be bigger, you know, just in general. You know, you've seen the last couple Grand Tour winners being more robust individuals, and Fabbro is, in many sense, you know, he's like an old school Italian climber. I mean, he's got to weigh less than, you know, probably 48, 50 kilos. He's a tiny guy. So the fact that, you know, he's still able to move his, you know, weight around the peloton and get to the front, you know, before the climbs is really impressive. But he's definitely kind of flourished this year with Bora.
He's 52 kilos according to Pro Cycling Stats, but that's yeah, tiny, like a little jockey almost.
There was one point today when Sagan was tucked in behind him on the climb, and I think Sagan got down in the drops just to try to get a bit more draft. And it, you know, on TV doesn't really show it, but if they were to stand next to each other, I mean, Sagan would look like Fabbro would be his breakfast.
Maybe Sagan didn't even realize he was there and thought he was on the front.
possible.
Can I ask Ian about Ryder?
Yes.
Ian, the stage winner, Ulissi. Now, we discussed him, obviously, after his first stage win. 8 stage wins, I think, now, as of today. And it struck me watching the stage this afternoon that he really is... His characteristics are very, very similar to Julien Alaphilippe. But he's kind of a Costco. I'm using, throwing in some American references here. He's kind of a Trader Joe's Alaphilippe. But it's kind of difficult to put your finger on why, because if you look back at his results, for example, in Flèche Wallonne, I mean, he's His best results are sort of 8th, 9th, 10th place. So he's been quite a distance from winning races like that. And, you know, I mean, it's probably just simply a question of quality. And he's simply not quite, you know, he's a few percent inferior to Alaphilippe. But what have you made of him, both watching him, you know, in the Giro and also riding alongside him in the peloton?
You know, to be quite honest, he's a rider that clearly has had good results over his career. But he's one of those riders, for some reason, that he's never really talked about all that much within the peloton or when, you know, in team meetings, people aren't saying, "Hey, what, we have to watch out for Ulisse today." And you see his track record at races in Italy, and it's, you know, he seems to really shine racing on Italian roads. And I don't know why that is. I mean, you saw today, I mean, there was on the first climb, the breakaway caught up to Simon Pallode. And I mean, the road's so narrow that he stopped and got off his bike on the side of the road so the peloton could pass. And I wonder if it's a case where Ulisse spent so much time, you know, riding and racing in Italy, and the fact that the roads there and just the style of racing is different enough than racing in France or Belgium that he's possibly just more, you know, in tune and adept to racing those roads. And who knows, Italians love their food. Maybe it's a dietary thing. When he's in Italy, he's got good pasta.
He did say, oh, I like it. Does he like risotto at all as well,
oh,
Ian?
God, no,
but he did say in Agrigento, which was the same day as Liège-Bastogne-Liège, wasn't it, that would be the race he would most like to win. So it clearly isn't down to desire. It's more, I don't know. I mean, he's actually had a really good season this year.
I mean, he's also a rider who's spent his whole career in the same organisation, Lampre, which has become UAE. And it just made me wonder today I don't know if he's ever had the opportunity to move to De Koninck Quickstep, but what they might have made of him.
He's got the same coach as Pog. Inigo San Milan coaches just, I think, four riders on that team. Pog, Ulisse, Rui Costa, and one other who I cannot remember, but I'll find out.
Just a mention for Simon Pallode, who was in the break when they were caught. Ian mentioned it. He actually pulled into the corner, right in the corner, to let the rest of the group go past because the road was pretty narrow. He actually got off his bike or stopped with his bike and gave a little round of applause as the bunch went past and retweeted a video of him doing that, saying, you know, he's always wanted to watch the Giro, or a nice day out watching the Giro, or something like that. That was quite a nice little moment.
Brandon McNulty is the other rider that San Milan coaches.
Yeah, and he was quite good today as well. I mean, he did the lead out for Ulisse, and he's really kind of come to the fore this in his first Grand Tour.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you would like 25% off, that's 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code Ian.
SISCP25.
You see, Daniel, it's really not that difficult.
Yeah.
Obviously, he wasn't paying attention there. Thanks to Science and Sport. And another announcement regarding Stacey Snyder's beautiful mugs. Her final batch of Grand Tour mugs go on sale on Tuesday, the day that the Vuelta gets underway. They're lovely. Well, they've got red in them for the Vuelta. They're very nice. And no doubt they'll sell out again very quickly. They're raising money for two good causes, the Bahati Foundation in Los Angeles and the Black Cyclist Network in the UK. They go on sale at 10 a.m. US East Coast time, 3 p.m. UK time, and 4 p.m. Spanish time. Go to Stacey's Etsy site to try and get your mug. And they've always gone very quickly, and we're grateful to Stacey for her hard work. So get yourself a mug by going to Stacey's Etsy site. There's also details about that in our newsletter. You can sign up to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com. Shall we hear the latest from our Samuel Pepys, James Knox, De Koninck Quickstep rider, very visible again today, really driving that group to the finish with Fausto Masnada. I kind of wondered why they were working so hard, and I think in this diary entry, well, he explains why.
Hi, everyone. First off, been receiving some very nice messages about the audio diary. So many thank you, many thanks for that. Glad people are enjoying my my view on the race. And I'll stick with the current format. If everyone's happy with that, feel free to ask any questions. Anyone who's listening, because always got time to chip away at them. Getting on to today, a bit gutted to be honest. Almost had a stage victory in the pink jersey, which would have been beautiful. Struggling to get over this one, as is life, you know. We'll come back tomorrow, but yeah, shit. Oh, I really thought we were gonna win. I was ready to post up and put my hands in the air. When I saw them opening up, but yeah, just didn't get round, did he? Half a wheel in it at the end, but yeah. Other than that, I can think we can say what a team performance. Pretty young team. Not a GC team on paper, but here we are. Didn't really have big ambition for the day either. We just sort of, you know, play by ear. If they tear it up, they tear it up. We've got different options. We'll be ready for whatever. Obviously, keep the pink jersey in front. That's the main priority, and then go from there. But yeah, the race panned out. There was, full noise, last climb. UAE ripped it up. Elisi launched. Wasn't easy, really wasn't easy, but first priority was staying in, staying hard, making sure Joao was protected, Joao had someone to set the pace and stop people from chipping off, which I needed to do. It was only a few hundred metres to the top of the climb, but did that, took the descent. Weird when you're in front. Normally I'm not a big risk taker, but suddenly when you're behind the motorbikes, you're full noise on the descent. I don't really know what happens. It's always the same, but yeah, tried to take the descent safely, but was going pretty quick. And then it was carnage. It was hard because I was in front. You got people blaring over the radio, shouting. Didn't really know what was going on. Obviously I'd come past Honore and Ballerini exploding on the climb, so in my mind they were out the race. They were done and dusted. I thought we had like a 15 man front group when I looked back at the top of the climb, but obviously there was a bit of regrouping. Honore shouting, screaming at me on that little roundabout coming off the descent, so I could wait for him. He got onto the group, and then it's this moment, it's split second decisions. We made the call, back Joao, went for it. Me and Fausto chopped off. Held Sagan and Swift and DeGent off, though. Tell my grandkids about that. Held Sagan off on a flat road, 12K. Pretty smug with myself. But yeah, did what we had to do. We set the tempo, rode basically as hard as we could, you know, set off at what felt like a good pace, which turned into an unbearable pace. That last 5K was just torture, but we kept the pace high. And then Mikkel was responsible for the lead-out duties because he's a lot better than me and Joao. Sorry, what am I on about? Me and Fausto for doing a lead-out. He can actually sprint. We can't sprint, so it's a big difference in it. And then, as everyone saw, we got awfully close to the win, but we didn't get the win. So, a bit of shame. A bitter shame. Winning a stage wearing the pink jersey would have been really, whatever happens, would have been the icing on the cake for the team, I reckon. So, yeah, we'll get over that, but was very disappointed. Apologies for being a bit dramatic over the line. I've just seen now pictures of me with hands over my face and hands on my head, looking a bit ridiculous, but yeah, I was pretty good. Spent 3 weeks in Italy now, so just overly dramatic, hands all over the place. There's no need for it, but anyway. Other than that, it was a nice day. Started with plenty of gear on. Looked around. I think I was about as geared up as anyone. Full jerseys, winter kit, long finger gloves, caps, buff, you name it. I was wearing it. And it was lovely to be warm. And then stripped it all off with 70k to go and got into the race. That was nice. Love that. Really love that. Needed that. And then a TT tomorrow. And yeah, we'll see how Joao goes. I think we've all got high hopes. Let's put it that way. But anyway, thanks again, everyone. Thanks for all the support. And we'll keep plugging away, fighting for pink.
Well, Rich, you said we'd learn a little bit more about why they were going so hard. I don't think James Knox actually covered it there. I've got another theory. João Almeida. Now, you guys will have to tell me if this was widely picked up and mentioned in commentary on various channels today. But João Almeida used to live about 4 or 5 kilometers from the finish today. Did anyone mention that? Because he did a season with the Trevigiani, the Italian under 23 team called Trevigiani, and they have a house in a place called Pozzonovo, which is about 5k from Monselice, where the stage finished. So I wondered whether that was one reason that he was particularly interested in winning the stage, for sort of sentimental reasons. Of course, what it will also mean is that he will know the course, he will know the roads that he's riding on tomorrow in the time trial very well, because again, anyone who lives in that region, well, another place that they will frequently train is in the sort of hills near Conegliano, sort of Prosecco region, so I guess he'll be on very familiar terrain tomorrow. Just another bit of sort of local, well, not so much local colour, but a bit of a nod to the course today. We passed very close. Napalm, you might remember this from our Giro. We sort of rerouted to go through this particular town or little village, but it was very close to the actual route today. A place called Vo Euganeo, which is where the first person in Italy died from COVID, way back in March.
Well, yes, Daniel, that very sad, and that was the very start of the COVID crisis in Europe, really, wasn't it? And of course, the race is carrying on under the cloud of COVID-19, and we talked about it a little bit last night. Jonathan Vaughter's comments initially to Orla Chenoui on the breakaway on Eurosport, talking about the possibility of ending the Giro on Sunday, this coming Sunday, so before the second rest day, and cutting the race short by a week. And it's not garnered universal support at all, has it? It's not really an idea that has been picked up by anybody. Quite the opposite, in fact, today, Daniel.
No, chaps. I mean, you'll have to briefly tell me what you guys thought of it and what you guys said last night.
We didn't listen to the podcast, like Daniel.
Sorry, Rich. I've been replacing my computer today. It's been tough. It's been a very tough day. I was nursing a cold that was the legacy of my time with you on the Giro. So it's been a battle.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, I mean, it's interestingly, Vaught has said today that even his own riders were not behind the move to cancel the race on Sunday. He said they want to carry on racing. I don't know. It seems a bit, well, we said last night that, you know, if he wanted to withdraw the team, he could, and perhaps without penalty and in these circumstances. You know, if he's worried, because the concern he says he has is for his rider's health, which is absolutely fair enough. But if that's the case, doesn't need the UCI to make a decision on it, could just withdraw the team. I don't know. I mean, I said last night, I swing one way and then the other with this. Because you know, Michael Matthews, for example, I mentioned this last night, you know, he's put a video message up tonight, he's had two negative tests for COVID now since having a positive one. So this, you know, idea that, or fear that we had, that Sunweb were perhaps the next team to fall, you know, with perhaps cases multiplying in that team. Well, if there wasn't a case there in the first place, then that seems unlikely. So some of the fears have kind of dissipated a little bit this week.
I mean, I personally thought it was tactless is the word that I would use. It's a bit like when someone buys you, or I don't know if this has ever happened to you, when someone buys you a self-help book for Christmas, but not a self-help book. Not a self-help book that's about self-optimization, more in the sort of self-laceration vein, a kind of you're a really bad person, here's 10 ways to change, that kind of thing.
But I am getting some good Christmas present ideas as you talk.
I'm ordering three.
I really didn't think it was Jonathan Vorter's place to make suggestions about what the other teams should be doing, unless, you know, his advice and his expertise is coming from a world-leading virologist, which I don't believe is the case. I think, you know, this was the opinion of his head of medical at the team. Well, all the teams have their own doctors in there. And, you know, they're neither more nor less qualified, I don't suppose, than EF Education. So, yeah, I thought it lacked sensitivity, and it was also... I think you have to see it in the context of, certainly when you look at the reactions of people like Luca Shinto, the Vini Zabu direct sportif, and Gianni Savio today. I think the broader context is one of an Italian, well, not just Italian cycling, but old world cycling, you could call it French cycling, Spanish cycling, which has seen its kind of prestige diminish over the years. It's seen its success levels diminish as well. And I think there's a feeling that there's a kind of moral superiority complex, a kind of, well, a sporting superiority complex as well, in the Anglo-Saxon teams. And also, another thing that the Italians have lost, and, you know, the French and the Spanish as well, is that English is now the lingua franca of professional cycling. And it's, you know, they have felt for a long time as though the English teams are sort of, and English speaking teams have parked their tanks on their lawn. And so they don't take kindly, I don't think, to any suggestion that they see as being, you know, unsolicited or out of place. So I think that's what happened. But as far as the current situation in Italy is concerned, there was a good piece today by Marco Bonarigo, a colleague of ours in the Corriere della Sera, which sort of looked at the numbers and pointed out that currently the Giro is statistically, it's a safer place to be in Italy than workplaces where people are being tested, and schools where people are being tested. The rates of positive cases are much lower, not slightly lower, but much lower.
In the Giro, you mean?
The Giro, sorry, yeah. So, I mean, it seems to me today, that the situation has calmed down a bit. EF have been more diplomatic today. I mean, the other aspects of it is why this was made public, whether it was deliberately leaked to create pressure on the other teams. It was certainly something that I thought could have been discussed in private.
He's not an isolated voice. Thomas De Gendt has expressed his misgivings. We've heard from Rick Zabel. Obviously, Jos van Emden as well on the podcast have expressed their unhappiness. And I suppose I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here, but, you know, riders are, you know, Thomas De Gendt is a rider with a reputation, a standing where he can probably voice his opinion more than other riders can. And Vota is maybe voicing something that he does pick up from riders who are a bit nervous or scared.
Well, voicing your opinion is one thing, Rich, but trying to, well, the way it's been, where you could perceive it is lobbying the other teams to leave the race, or suggesting they ought to, or that it would be safe to, it would be irresponsible not to leave the race or stop the race. I think that's a different thing personally.
Can you put yourself in that position? Imagine you were riding the Giro, Ian. How do you think you would be feeling, and how confident would you feel about speaking out if you were worried?
I mean, I think it really depends on, you know, one, where you are in the race. And we kind of touched on it a bit last night, the fact that, you know, EF has already won two stages. They have, you know, Rubens in the KOM jersey. So, you know, if the race stopped on Sunday, they'd walk away with a relatively successful Giro. But there are a lot of teams at the race that still are fighting for something. And personally, if I was there, I would, you know, to be quite honest, my decision would be based entirely on where I was. If I was up for a contract, if I'd, you know, had a good season, maybe I'd be inclined to say, hey, I'm happy to head home and call it a year. But if I was still, you know, searching for a contract, as so many riders are this year, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want to walk away from the race. You know, inherently cycling is dangerous. Riders know that, you know, COVID is, you know, is something else, but I think riders are somewhat accustomed to kind of calculating risk involved in what we do. Yeah, and thanks for tipping me off that Lawson Craddock had left the race. I didn't know that, and I called him this morning, and he was in the hospital with his new baby boy back in Texas. He is from Texas, unlike Larry. I feel like, you know, if Lawson was able to leave the race on his, you know, own accord, that he felt, you know, COVID cases were rising in Italy and, you know, JV and the team allowed him to leave, that if there were riders within any given team, most particularly within EF, then I feel like those riders would have the right and the ability to leave. I just don't necessarily feel like, you know, if EF chooses to walk away and leave the race, they can, but I'm assuming they're going to start Flanders this weekend and they're going to start the Vuelta as well. So, you know, where do you kind of draw the line of, you know, doing what's morally correct and then trying to put that pressure on other teams?
I think this is maybe a minor point as well, but I think it's slightly galling for Mauro Venni and the organizers, RCS, when they know that Jonathan Vaughters is not at the race. And you know, he can't be at the race, I don't think. He can't travel. But when someone is sort of basing their overall view of how dangerous it is or isn't on, you know, the sort of secondhand testimonies, which is the same as what we've had on the podcast. You know, in our minds, Rich, for example, we were there last week, you know, that occupies a certain amount of space in our minds, you know, what we hear from Jos van Emden, but a much bigger, you know, we can form a much better view really based on what we saw every day there, you know. So I think for Mauro Venni, you did make some comment, it's something to the along the lines of, I haven't seen Vaughters here, which, you know, it's not Jonathan Vaughters' fault, but I think that probably made it even more galling.
I also think that, you know, looking at the wider picture, whilst we don't want people riding on in unsafe circumstances, either for the people who are within the race bubble or the wider public, the first race that is seriously curtailed would set some sort of precedent. I mean, we're clearly going to be living with this for the foreseeable future. We may be in a similar situation next season. The calendar may well go ahead in a much more familiar way with races where we would normally expect them to be, but there may well be flare-ups locally or across Europe or across the world that professional sport has to deal with. And you know, it's not terribly you know, we can't really have a scenario where at the sort of the first sign of something you know, being amiss, events are just cancelled, because once they are cancelled, they're cancelled and a precedent is set. And I think stand by what I said yesterday, really, which is that, you know, whilst it's, you know, relatively under control and you know, lots of regular life is going on in Italy, you know, as close to normal as is possible, it's, you know, it seems that the best thing is to take it one day at a time and, you know, judge it. The people who are running the race make the decision together with local authorities to see whether it's right to continue. And when they say it's not right to continue, that's when the race should stop.
Just a final thing I'd say, just to break it down to very, very simple terms, is that, you know, we often talk on the podcast about Italian hospitality, you know, whether it's in restaurants or hotels. And as far as Mauro Venni and as far as, you know, the likes of Luca Shinto and other Italians are concerned, EF and foreigners that come to Giro, they're guests. And this reminded me a little bit of the restaurant critic A.A. Gill. I remember a column he once wrote about dinner parties, how he hated dinner parties because, you know, often the food was terrible. And he wrote about the occasion when he'd walked out of a dinner. He'd first complained at a dinner party, and then when the food came back and it still wasn't his satisfaction, he'd walked out.
Is this the equivalent of Jonathan Vaughters serving a plate of pasta with the sauce just piled on the top?
Yeah.
A.A. Gill and Jonathan Vaughters, not a million miles apart in some ways. I'd say that as a huge admirer of A.A. Gill, sadly. Passed away a couple of years ago, but
I thought you were going to say huge admirer of Jonathan Vaughters. Then
and that was well, what you were supposed implication, to say. The implication is
we all admire. We all admire Jonathan. We can disagree. We can disagree on, you know. On
I was just going to mention Tour of Flanders. I mean, you mentioned Tour of Flanders, and yeah, I think I don't have the facts to back this up, but my impression is that there are more cases in Belgium than in Italy at the moment. And as you say, they are starting Tour of Flanders. But I was just curious, just a little sideline. most American riders are linked with EF at some point because it's been the kind of the standard bearer for American cycling for a long time. As Jonathan often says, it's the longest running US professional team in history, I believe, has set up. Did you ever come close to joining that team? Were you ever, was it ever a possibility, Lionel? Ian? Ian?
No, I actually never, I think maybe I exchanged like one or two messages with JV. But no, I never actually came close to riding with that team. And for better or worse,
I've been told. Did you upset him on Twitter?
I have not. No, I didn't. I didn't fall to some of his Twitter tweets, and as Larry Warbass did. But no, I at one point I did ask Dombrowski for his number to send him a text when I was up for contract at Team Sky. But I no, I wound up staying at Team Sky. And yeah, I mean, like I said, for better or worse, I never went to EF. And I've heard, you know, all sorts of different stories about American riders to that team, but you know, I felt like there were a lot of young American riders that became JV's projects, and yeah, thankfully I was never one of his projects.
Oh, this sounds like something worth exploring for a friend special, I think.
Well, stick, you've seen, I mean, I don't want to call anyone out, but there have been quite a few American talents that have come up, and JV's definitely taken them under his wing, and they haven't always, maybe I don't want to say never, but have very seldom kind of, you know, achieved the level of competition that JV had anticipated for them. And I think, you know, Dombrowski's maybe alluded to that a little bit, and there are other riders, you know, Phil Guymon as well. And yeah, so I mean, I really don't have anything to say about JV because I haven't had, I've had very little interactions with him over the course of my career.
Well, Jonathan, if you're listening, Ian came that close to texting you and asking for a contract. Never quite happened.
One self-help book that Ian Boswell doesn't need to receive for Christmas: how to use adverbs to devastating effect. Thankfully, I was never one of his projects.
This is great. Well, listen, I tuned in today to the De Koninck Quickstep press conference ahead of Tour of Flanders. Julian Alaphilippe, the world champion, making his debut there. He revealed as well that on Monday he is going for lunch with Eddie Merckx. I didn't tell him to watch out for the chocolate mousse. You'll have to listen to last night's podcast, Daniel, to understand.
Yeah, I saw this.
Reference.
I didn't know what this was.
You'll have to listen. We'll give you a time code to help you. But anyway, he was asked a question by our colleague Jan-Peter de Vlieger from Het Nieuwsblad, which made me and a lot of other people chuckle. Here it is.
Yes, a question for Julian. After Liège and Brabantse Pijl, can we assume that if you go to the finish line for the win that you will only be raising your hands until after the line, even if you were to go solo in the ronde?
Yes.
Well, I said the question made me chuckle. It didn't make Alaphilippe chuckle. He didn't have much of a sense of humour about the famous, now famous incident at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, where he stuck his hands up too early and Primoz Roglic came past him. And then he almost did it. Well, he did do it again at Brabantse Pijl, but just held on. So, yeah, not much of a sense of humour about that. You ever done that, Ian? Ever stuck your hands up in the air and mistimed it, or there was someone up the road that you didn't know about?
No, I wasn't a very prolific winner over the course of my career. No, that never happened, thankfully. But yeah, I mean, every time you see it, you always wonder why people don't. I mean, because isn't it actually a UCI rule that you have to cross the finish line with two hands on the bars?
That is a UCI rule. That is right. Yeah, but it's one of these ones that's overlooked, unlike other, you know, rules about socks length and things like that. But yeah, that certainly always was the case, that you're not technically allowed to take your hands off the bars. Yeah.
Time
trial.
Should
we wrap things up?
No, we shouldn't.
Tomorrow.
No.
Yeah. No, tomorrow. Okay. Yeah. Who's going to be in the pink jersey tomorrow evening, Daniel?
João Almeida. I think he's going to take time out of everyone. I think he might even win the stage.
Wilco Mann?
Wilco Mann's time trials are quite difficult. If you look at his record over the past two or three years, quite difficult to read and decipher because he's been fighting injury a lot of the time. He's done some excellent time trials And he's done some, for example, in Poe in the Vuelta last year. It was one I'm just looking at where he lost over 2 minutes to Roglic, tore 2.5 minutes to Roglic. And based on performances like that, you'd say he might be looking to limit his losses tomorrow. But I don't know. He's got it in. He's definitely got a good time trial in him. And as we've said thus far in this Giro, he's obviously in fantastic form. And it's a hilly time trial. I suspect that it's one that will kind of magnify the effect of form over specialization, so he could go well. But I think Almeida, again, this is based on fairly thin evidence as well, because he's such a young rider that he doesn't have, you know, 5 years of time trials at the top level behind him. But what he's done so far has been impressive, and I think he'll do well and possibly finish in the top three or four.
Is the course too hard tomorrow for someone like Ghana?
I don't know, Ian. There's this very steep wall of which is about a kilometre long after not many kilometres. It's in the first 10K of the route. And after that, it's sort of rolling. But, you know, how much of an effect would that have? I think it's over 10% climb. 1 kilometer long. How much of an effect would that have?
I'm gonna go with Brandon McNulty for the time trial tomorrow. He's been riding well. Wow. And yeah, he's produced some decent time trials over the course of his career.
I'll go for Mikael Bjerg to win the time trial, maybe, or Ghana. But Bjerg looks like he's in great form. Lionel?
Well, I don't speculate on these sorts of things. It's very difficult to call. I think Castroviejo for the stage, maybe.
Just one little thing on Wilco Man. The best Wilco Man we've seen was probably 2017 Vuelta, when he was fourth overall, and in a time trial there around Navarra, he was second to Chris Froome over 40 kilometers. Took 30 seconds out of Nibali that day. And I think you're right, Daniel, that it's all about form, and he looks to be in great form. So I expect him to go well, but it might just be Bjerg, Ghana type, and McNulty as well. As you say, Ian, he's looked to be in great form too. But I think we expect Almeida to still be in pink, don't we, tomorrow night?
Just looking, Castroviejo hasn't done a decent time trial for about 2 years, so maybe not him. Who knows? We'll tune in. We'll watch it and find out, won't we?
That's usually what we do, yeah. That's usually what we do. Well, we'll wrap it up. We're being joined by you again tomorrow night, Ian.
We are.
And you, Daniel.
You sound a bit less enthusiastic about that. You sound absolutely delighted that you'd have Ian back, not so much me.
No, I'm delighted about
that. It
can
be arranged, Richard. It can be arranged for me not to participate.
He'll be taking his screwdriver to his laptop as soon as he's put the phone down.
I'm delighted that you'll be joining us too, Daniel. And you, Lionel. Fantastic. Oh, what a treat.
Yeah, great. Yeah, good. Good.
Right, listen, before we go, some thanks to friends of the podcast. From me, a big thank you to Rowan Walker, Keith Dorling, Trish Webster, Jane Davis, Paul Cackett, and William Davis.
And for me, Gary Fogelman, CJ Rose, Jay Cox, Michael Duig, is that correct?
Duig, I think.
Lee Thompson, and Corey Cassidy.
And from me to T. Stainthorpe, David Malloy, Mark Duffy, T. Trotman, Diane Stallwood, and Alfredo Gisolt. And I actually know Paul Cackett in real life. So hello, Paul, if you're listening.
I'm pretty sure T. Trotman will be Toby Trotman, who we also know, publisher.
Of course, yeah. Publisher of our book, The Grand Tour Diaries.
Hello, I actually Toby. Have a question. I've been paying my £15 a year for 3 years now, but I've never heard my name being thanked.
And Ian Boswell.
There we go.
And from me to Julian Moore, Stuart Trimby, Jonathan Cox, Antonio Gord, possibly, A. Lacey, and Jerem Collier.
Thank you, fellas.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Rich.